that the minister has been talking about. The question of paying small businesses and PE business within 30 days. It's a very important thing because it talks to cash flow management. What we've realized that some departments and some SOCs, they use small businesses as their cash flow management. So they don't pay because they want to manage their cash. And the small business can't, but big businesses are paid. And why do they pay big business? If you don't pay big business, they take you to court. Small business does not have money to take you to court, right? So you can play around with them. So what we've been saying to the department is that let's find ways of making sure that that happens. It doesn't, it's not rocket science, but it's very important to the survival of PEs and the survival of small and medium micro enterprises. But lastly, Chair, I think, again, we, important as this department is, National Treasury, it's a myth that on its own it will be able to change the economy and the structure of the economy. We need everybody. We are just one of the many departments. We've got different roles to play. And I think from our side, we do want to work as a team and try and get as many people as possible, all the departments, to follow on the policies that as government we have adopted. And then the last challenge to the committee. Let's avoid megaphone diplomacy. We are taking a view that we don't know it all. We are taking a view that we also would like this committee to treat us as their partners, right? As a committee and as individual members of this committee. Let's talk about certain issues. Let's discuss issues. We don't need to wait for a committee meeting before we raise issues. Honorable Menir, and this one, is, if there are views, and we're going to differ with you, right? But there's nothing stops you from saying to the Minister, can we meet and discuss? And let's discuss these things, Mazamban, Brendan and Floyd. That's fine. I'm not afraid of any debate. But the fact of the matter is that's the fact of the matter is we are saying that we are open. Let's discuss. We are seeing this committee as our partners. Thanks, Chair.
I know there are follow-ups, but can I raise a question? Can I just clarify? Ultimately, it's a decision of the committee. We are here actually to look at the department's strategic and APP, so it's strategic plans. The discussion has mainly been about the economy and the ministry's political perspectives. We are into 1 hour and 45 minutes. We started 4 minutes late, so we've had this discussion for one hour 41 minutes. In our report to Parliament, this is going to occupy at most half a page. The main thing is the strat plan and so on. So I really think that, you know, I'm asking members for guidance. Because we really have to look at what we are here for. These issues are dealt with when the minister brings the budget to Parliament. But because of the special circumstances, there's a new minister and so on and so on, and there's an interest in how we've allowed this. But strictly, you know, in a normal situation like next year at this time, well, I don't know who will be chairing here, but presumably the chair would do the same. Restrict that to half an hour. Well, that's the way we've been done. But I'll allow quick questions and quick replies. For two of you have got questions, right? Right. So David, you had Yana first, then it's Floyd, and then it's Brandon. Can I also plead with both sides? Brief questions, brief answers. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be brief. Minister, on the whole question of economic policy, I mean, the economy is not growing, and the economy is not growing because there's insufficient private sector investment. And there's insufficient private sector investment because of policy uncertainty. I mean, do you concede that the continuous somersaulting between radical economic transformation, inclusive economic growth, with a dash of nationalization of the banks, nationalization of mines, taking up arms, or whatever the case may be, do you not concede that this is causing uncertainty and doing harm to the economy in South Africa? And if you do, what are you doing about it? First question. Second
I'm really worried. You're asking like loaded questions. The ground's been covered. I'm cheering. He's answered that question, really. So anyway, quickly, the second question.
Second question is, again, on the economic advisory. In your response, you said that your economic advisor had now been reined in. But that is just objectively not true. You made the statement, I think, on the 19th of April 2017 that your economic advisor had been reined in and told to keep quiet. He has not been reined in, and he is not keeping quiet. In fact, he's doing exactly the opposite. He's addressing public meetings, and your whole approach to your economic advisor is based on a false assumption. There cannot be a firewall between the minister and his economic advisor. When his economic advisor is making mad statements on the economy, it is a reflection on the minister, who doesn't seem capable of reining in or telling his economic advisor to keep quiet. You have distanced yourself again from your economic advisor's views. And so my question to you is, why do you employ an economic advisor that you don't listen to? Simple as that. The last question is to...
No, that's three questions. David, you're now taking advantage. Okay. When are we going to look at who's... I'll be dumped with a report. Who's going to write the report ultimately?
I'll be 1 second.
Right, 1 second, that's it.
The Honourable Buthelezi said, well, there are no ideas that shouldn't be heard. I agree that, there should be freedom of speech and everybody's free to put their ideas, including the economic advisor. But there's one idea which I don't think should be supported, and that is the idea of the minister's economic advisor suggesting or even seeming to suggest that individuals take up arms in South Africa to achieve radical economic transformation. And I'd like the minister to make a clear statement.
Thanks, right. Floyd.
Thank you, Chair. So the minister says that the still deliberations on what radical economic transformation means. But in the same sentence, he says it's in pursuit of radical economic transformation. Which one are you in pursuit of? Because what the president of the ANC says is some waffling definition, which has got no meaning, but a Deputy President is something completely different. What you say is radical economic transformation is different. You are right that there is no coherent one conceptualization of what is radical economic transformation. You even mentioned first and second economy, some confusion that refuses to accept a basic reality that a capitalist economy will of course have the two sides. It's inherent under capitalism that will have a section that is integrated to global economy and a section that is just for ordinary people that are not there. And I think you're adding more to the confusion. I think it's the conceptual issues that you must clarify, you know, in his. And what Comrade Chris was trying to do was to try to define what a radical economic transformation program could be to you. And it identifies 7 points in the document which he wrote now recently. And it's different from the radical 7 cardinal pillars of the EFF. He mentions establishment of a state bank,
nationalization
of the reserve bank,
and
so on and so forth. But I think we need
to
change. I allowed David to speak on 3 points. I'm going to deal with that. We have to expose the ideological poverty upon which this radical economic transformation is said to be existing. The reality of the matter is that the new liberal agenda and program, premised on the NDP, continues to be the foundation of national treasury, because everything else that could be radical is being disjointed. Now, lastly, the minister says that it's below the belt to speak about people's wives when we're discussing politics, but your wife invited us to politics. She's the one who spoke about Home Affairs. Home Affairs, when you speak about Home Affairs, you're speaking about us now. She's the one who said that she's got an IT solution for Home Affairs, and she gave it to you, and it became successful. And then you are saying to us that, no, she only gives you the problems. She doesn't come with the solutions. She's the one who made that pronouncement. So we must be concerned that your wife has invited us into politics. You must then answer here as to, is she going to give you solutions like she was doing in Home Affairs, because she says that she did in Home Affairs? And did she attend meetings with you official meetings of government, when you're on an official trip? That is the questions that we have asked and you have not answered in terms of all of this. But Chair, there is nothing that has changed. I don't know what the DA's concern is, because what have been the advices of a radical program to transform the economy are not on the table. The NDP is continuing as a neoliberal framework of the National Treasury. There's nothing that is changing. They're just waffling. That is why there's no consensus on what is meant by radical economic transformation.
Next, please. Brandon, precise, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'll speak later, because a lot of what I want to say comes from the plan coming forward. But to say that I think the minister's going to have a hard time looking after his wife, because my wife tells me what to do all the time, and she then just complains I don't listen. So I think the rest of South Africa is going to say, that's a good wife, we must do some swapping over here.
Over to you, Minister. Can I suggest, Minister, that actually the issues are quite loaded. We look for another opportunity where we look at those issues. I'm very worried that we've got less than an hour and we have to do the main task of business. But I'll hand over to you a maximum of 8 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you. No, Honorable David. The reasons why there are no, as you say, the economy is not growing because of uncertainty, I think these are new reasons now, excuses that are being provided. There have been many reasons in the past as to why this is happening, why that is happening, and these reasons keep shifting. We are at a stage, we've actually moved far away from where Honorable David is, where we are now engaging with business to attract, to draw in investments. We're beyond this talk, I think he needs to join in. Secondly, the advisor last had an engagement on the 29th of April, and what keeps happening is that people now keep rehashing his views. And as I say, I am the minister, not my advisor, not the DG. I am the minister. It is my views that prevail. It is my policies, the policies that I draw from cabinet and nobody else's. But let me also say, the advisor has since been taken through government induction to understand how government works, what's the role of advisors. It's peculiar to have an advisor being discussed in any government department in this fashion. But you can understand, it comes from the academic background, and there are practices there that we have to understand, but he also had to understand how government works. He's been taken through government induction, and he will continue his role as an advisor to the minister. But the minister is ultimately myself. Honorable Floyd, it would seem to me, and we can engage in this debate forever, the ANC economic policy and that of the EFF are not the same, and perhaps the confusion is on your side. And I think that's what we may need to agree to. The ANC's economic policy is premised on a mixed economy, and it acknowledges the role both of the public and the private sectors. The extent to which the public or the private sector will increase or reduce its role depends on the balance of evidence at each given time. You may not agree with that. It's the ANC's economic policy, and the ANC itself may not agree with some of the things that you call your economic policies. With regard to the interview, I wish to repeat again. In the first instance, my wife has not attended any official meeting with me. In the second instance, the interview, she did not invite herself to the interview. The interview was, she was invited to the interview. She was asked questions to which she had to answer, because when a question is asked, you cannot stand up and walk away. But it is important to say that your statements are fundamentally untrue, that she made any reference to her telling me what IT solutions. She works in the IT sector. She works in the IT sector. I don't know where your wife works. She works in Parliament. But I don't think she's going to impose on you how you should conduct yourself as an MP. I hope she hopes she helps you change your uniform to Parliament. But that really, I don't think you should take those issues serious and make meat and bone out of them. You will get opinions from a whole range of people, including your wife, about virtually everything. And I think, as Honorable Brendan was saying, it applies to everyone. I don't think that we should even attempt to take cheap shots at one another using our families. It is me who is a politician. It is me you must engage with as a politician. We can debate on an equal footing as politicians. Don't bring my family. I will not bring yours too. I'm not that cheap. Thank you.
We have to draw to a close, but my job as a chair is to draw your attention to one or two other things, right? One of the things, needless to say, I'm sure you know, that we are getting obsessed about, if there's no other word, right, is this illicit financial flows. Now, let me just read to you. The GFI report states, this is now between 2003 and 2012, we lost, it's estimates, and it's probably underestimates, right, 122 billion outflows. Financial Intelligence Center said over a 10-year period we lost over 600 billion. The GFI notes these illicit outflows sapped 5.7% of the GDP from sub-Saharan Africa over the last decade, more than any other region in the developing world. And most alarmingly, the outflows from sub-Saharan Africa were found to be growing at an average inflation-adjusted rate of more than 20%. Now, Minister, we've always needed to tackle this, but now more than ever before, given the shrinking revenues we've got because of the growth rates coming down. We have been putting a lot of pressure on a variety of stakeholders and three committees, trade and industry, minerals, and ourselves work on this. We are moving towards now saying that the three ministers need to convene some sort of structure. And we're finalizing a process at the moment, but we're going to write to you to say, look, man, we must do something more. SARS is trying, but I think my own view, I'm not sure to what extent the majority will agree, my own view, for what it's worth, is SARS needs to do more. Needs to upgrade its capacity and skills. I happened to go to some parliamentary conference, the first ever last December. And Minister, you know, even they in the advanced industrialized world, they keep saying these guys that do this thing, you know, this tax evasion thing, illicit financial flows, base erosion and profit shifting, they constantly upgrade their capacity and skills. So you constantly need, even in the West or North, they're saying they don't have the capacity in the police service, the prosecution service, the revenue service to do this. But we have to do more. On the legislative program, I raised with you fleetingly today. I hope a certain DDG, and DG is outgoing, note this. We are told you're going to bring 10 bills to us. Well, Minister, as I said to the previous Minister, which planet you come from? And while I'm saying this, I hope Mr. Mania is listening. Mr. Mania, once again, we're not going to discuss it, okay? The matters that belong to other portfolio committees, I've done my job. You must get your DA members there to deal with those issues. We will participate. Nuclear and so on. Now, we are being asked, Minister, I've raised this before. David, can you leave the Minister alone? I need the Minister to hear this, please. Minister, we've got an insurance bill that came to us in November 2015. Now, we have said to the DG, DDG, and the previous Minister, if your entities behave, all the entities that fall under you, then we'll have less need to ignore the legislation and focus on oversight. But we need to find the right balance between legislation and oversight. And right now, this quarter, I can tell you, we've discussed the matter. I think you got an email yesterday. I want us just to be frank. There's no discussion. We are focusing on the Rate and Monetary Bill, Money Bills Act, and the budget now. Those are the main things. Minister, we have a bill running into 72 pages. Insurance bill. CPC will know. November 2015. Last year, we processed close to 490 pages of legislation. It's four times the average. Now, please, Minister, When you give performance bonuses, this is a facetious remark, right? Because the person concerned is a very good comrade. He's been in the movement longer than he can remember, and he's not interested in money. But I'm tempted to say this. When you give performance bonuses, don't look at your DGs and DDs and say, how many bills have you introduced to Parliament? Right? But the more important thing, Minister, we've said this before, Sifiso will know, the DM, that actually sometimes we say to you, Minister and the Department, can you consult more with the stakeholders? Because what happens is they come to the Treasury, they present proposals, out of every 10 you reject 7, and then when they come to us, the very same proposals they've gone to you with, of the 7 you've rejected, we accept another 3, and we say the 4. So can you consult more? Don't just pile us up with bills. Having said that, I know you're not listening, Minister, because this guy is disrupting. You see, his agenda is not to process any bills. What he wants to do is plan for 2019. So his sole agenda is, where can I look for issues? So if there's an issue in health, you know what he will do? He will say, Eunice, can we look at the health issues? Never mind there's a health committee. Never mind there's a health committee chairperson will tell me, hey, Eunice, who the hell do you think you are? The minister himself says he's not a super minister. So can you please, we've taken a standing resolution, give him the minutes. We're not looking at those issues. Unless the chair of those committees convenes the meeting, we will go to it. So in short, Minister, we ain't able to process 10 bills. If you want us to process it, then fire some of your DDGs, put them on the list, you're an NEC and an NWC member, and put them on this side. Right? At the moment, 4 members, we've lost 2 people, the economist and the banker. Right? They're gone. Then there's one on study leave. Right? There's another one that's sick. So no 10 bills this year. Otherwise, you'll be the most unpopular minister and make your life very difficult. Not because of anything you're saying that's not valid, because we're mad at you for giving us 10 bills. Thank you. Having said that, can we move now on to the main meat, so to speak, of the matter? Thank you, Minister. Next year, whoever is here, it'll be half an hour of the Minister, half an hour questions, then we move on to the APP and the Strat Plan. I hope the Mr. Commissioner, our Commissioner is here. We will have to break into our lunch break. Thank you, Minister. You can go. Thank you very much. And DM. What we're asking now is, comrades, can you agree, colleagues? We're going to cut our lunchtime. Lunchtime's going to be cut, so we've got, it's 12 o'clock now. We'll sit till 1:20, 1:30. Over then to you on the Strat Plan and the APP. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. Someone has forgotten even that we're supposed to move the thing. Yes. So we on this slide, we just set out the mandate of the Treasury. You know, that's why I'm going to make sure that I go through this as slow as possible so that it's very clear to all of us. So we set out several things there, the enforcement of transparency, managing the budget, which this committee always assists us to process, of course, coordinating intergovernmental fiscal and financial relations, and quite importantly, we are responsible for financial systems, of which you know about the transition from the legacy systems, which are old, your pass and other things, to IFMS, on which we're making reasonably good progress right now. Of course, lastly, we promote national government's fiscal policy, which of course we assist the minister and the deputy minister in developing, and we coordinate macroeconomic policy as the PFMA expects us to. Now, these are just some of the overarching policy and political imperatives of the department. The minister covered this. We can just flip to the next one. Some of the important pieces of legislation that we will be coming with here, assuming that the chair and the committee give us permission, seems to be wanting to prevent us from doing this, that's fine. The procurement bill, quite advanced stages of development. The regulations were revised and gazetted on the 20th of January, so we assist now with implementing them. The tax on beverages, sugary beverages, has been talked about. And of course, then, if you flip to the next slide, these are some of our strategic focus areas, which we list here. The issue of growing the economy is always very important to us. But at the same time, it's important to understand that there is only so much that fiscal policy can do for growth, both in terms of juggling with expenditure and taxes, but even changing the composition of expenditure. You know, there is only so much that it can do. Growth has to come from policy certainty. Almost said that incorrectly, because the one prevails more than the other. We need policy certainty across a whole range of sectors. We need policy execution, very diligent policy execution, because it's one thing to have policies, it's yet another to implement them. You derive benefits from a policy only when you actually implement it. So we need all of those things. Of course, we will continue to look at our taxes in line with our development objectives, in line with our fiscal objectives, and so on. Contribute to employment, infrastructure development, and integrating our cities. I mean, I was not mandated to do this, but last week we visited eThekwini, and we saw some of the outcomes of what we have been preaching. The city is implementing a very good example of an integrated program, where social services, economic services, human settlements, nicely transport infrastructure, very nicely integrated. I actually think that even before the projects are completed, they would be a very beautiful candidate for a case study. Because if we replicate that in as many of our major cities as possible, then we will succeed in breaking down the apartheid special patterns. It's one thing not to like them and talk about them, but it's yet another to do something about them. And what you see there is a very good example of that. Procurement, making sure that government does not pay too much, making sure that procurement serves as an enabler for a whole range of economic and social development objectives, and of course, regulating the financial sector so that it serves us better. The issues of the systemic resilience of the financial sector, because when it collapses, we know the pain that it can cause, and we also know now how long that can last from the 2008-09 experience. But at the same time, we also have to pay attention to market conduct issues, how the sector treats its customers. Is it inclusive enough? Is it transparent in terms of the pricing of its products? And so on and so forth. Of course, our international agenda was talked a lot about earlier on. And of course, managing our assets and liabilities. The next slide just sets out the programs as you know them. The next slide talks to how the programs are funded. And the next slide presents the breakdown by classification. And of course, the next slide then talks to the details of the different programs. Now, the administration program, as you would know, that's the program that ensures that internally as an institution we function well. we have the ICT that we need. It does not break down when we are in the middle of producing an MTBPS or a budget. More often than not, we forget their importance until things don't work. When things stop working at a critical time, then we remember that they are important. So that's the function that they do. They just make sure that the organization functions as a unit. It's a cost-effective machinery. We can retain, we can attract talent, good talent, and we can retain it. We also, quite importantly through the unit, we can really build talent. I mean, we run one of the best, even if I have to say so myself, you know, when you're approaching retirement, you've got the liberties that young people don't have. We have a very vibrant intensive program where we get people who are trained in accounting, economics, help them bridge the gap between the theory and the practice in those fields. Last time I checked, the retention rate of that program, but this statistic is dated, now that the budget is constrained, there may be difficulties about this, but the retention rate was around 71%, because we get good young people, train them, and we would keep them. Some of them get snatched by other parts of the system earlier than they have really grown, but some of them have gone on to make very successful careers in the public service. So this unit is quite important. Then the next set of programs are programs that feed, or whose outputs feed into the budget. As a consequence, talking about them to you is very easy, because it's talking to you about your bread and butter. I mean, you may not like it, but it's your bread and butter that you've got to produce our legislation or process it. Sometimes, Honorable Menir, it's got to be long, these pieces of legislation, but it's not because incentives are distorted. We don't pay people by the length of the...
I'm joking.
We can't take ourselves too seriously all the time. So, some of the very important work that the Economic Policy Unit, the Tax and Financial Regulation Unit do, we summarize it on this slide, you know, doing some micro and macroeconomic research so that the policy advice we give to the minister and dare I say the entirety of government is informed by evidence, to the extent that there is evidence. The focus that we publish, which we had subjected to various tests earlier, and people felt that we were not as bad at this as we thought. Sometimes we were. It's just factors beyond our control which had impacted on this. I've talked about the Twin Peaks legislation and a whole lot of other things that are on this slide. Next slide, please. Of course, we will be taking, or undertaking rather, targeted expenditure reviews in the period ahead. One of the things that we want to look at, for an example, are our incentive programs. Just to understand, both the tax expenditures and also just the expenditure type incentives. Just to understand, you know, are they having the desired impact? What is the relationship between the changes they lead to and the policy objectives that we sought to accomplish when we introduced them as government, and therefore make the adjustments where necessary. Of course, we do monitoring of use of resources by departments. Of course, we're not fiscal police. We don't end up, you know, I mean, there is a part that we play in the system. In particular here, the most important element is just looking, for instance, at conditional grants. When there is funding that has got conditions, are the conditions of it met, and so on. And just to the extent that there are rules applicable to various pockets of expenditure, we check whether those are followed. Of course, we interact with other parts of the government to assist them with everything that they do, and very importantly, to prepare budgets right across government. Now, we also, of course, provide support to other spheres of government on matters of budgeting. We do very extensive oversight of budget preparation and budget execution processes in provinces and local government. I will qualify the latter one just now. But most people don't perhaps know this. I mean, we've got the division that's headed by Madi Jane Naleni. We look at the budgets of provinces and check them against the policy objectives that, especially for concurrent functions, that government has set, to see whether there is a reasonable degree of alignment between the policy objectives of government and the budget so that at least we don't just wish that things will happen. And we do tell people the uncomfortable stuff sometimes, very frankly, that we think, for instance, their budgets are not sufficiently aligned to the priorities of government. Of course, they exist as governments constitutionally, so we can't really direct them what to do, but we can tell them our views about what they do, and of course, when they come back to haunt them, we can say, we told you so, and we are very good at that. We also then have a category of municipalities that are undelegated. That means they are overseen by us, and we run a similar thoroughgoing process with them, about 17 of them. So, you know, your metros, secondary cities, we look at them, we check whether their budgets are really giving expression to the policy intent that's been agreed intergovernmentally, and to the extent that some of those programs are you know, funded through national transfers, earmarked transfers in some cases even. And of course we do interventions when it's necessary. First support, later on through directives, sections 100 and 139 of the constitutions, the A's and B's of those. Next is asset and liability management. We maintain investor relations through that program. We try to make sure that we can always raise money when we need it, and we can manage cash in the system and finance our borrowing in a way that synchronizes the inflows of tax revenues collected by our colleagues behind me with, of course, the outflows and so on. Let's go, Laura, to Program 5, Financial Systems and Supply Chain, touch on elements of this. I mean, the two big things under these programs can be summarized as follows. I mean, it's just, you know, integrated financial systems first, and I've referred to this. In fact, let me talk about three things under this. It's integrated financial management systems. We have got to move from our old systems to new ones, and the process has taken exceedingly long, but it is now moving forward. It helps that our counterparts at CETA are quite geared up, and we will move to implement this. They are very important because the ability to monitor spending and to report on it consistently in ways that ensure that our audit outcomes improve depend, among other things, of course, there are human factors and everything, on the financial management systems that we have. Second, on the second thing I would mention about the combined programs that are remaining is that we want to, on supply chain management, we want to modernize supply chain management. We want to make sure that we place it at the front and center of what we do, because the delivery of services in government depends a lot on supply chain management working. And more often than not, this is overlooked. If you are to build a road, for you to be able to actually have the yellow fleets on site doing the right things and so on, supply chain management has got to come in there, including, of course, making sure that the socio-economic development objectives are also part of that, you know, empowerment and so on. But very importantly, including making sure that you don't pay too much for something if you can afford to get it for less, especially in a constrained fiscal environment. So we're combining all of those things using IT to make sure that we can do things better, faster, and provide access to government the 500 billion that the minister was referring to. The third thing that I will say on the remaining programs is that then once all is said and done, we've spent the money and so on, we then must report on it and report in a way that people can understand, in a way that is transparent And that is where the OAG comes from, comes in. Financial management, the rules in terms of accounting and financial management, and of course the reporting thereon. I can see I've lost people because I'm summarizing. The last point I will make, and this is the very last point, is that one of the things that we have been doing for several years now, it started just during Momo's time in intergovernmental relations, continued through all of us going through that unit, but it has worked better. It looks like it needed a woman colleague to do, is to support both provinces and municipalities in terms of what they do, just broadly, but in relation to infrastructure, this is, but also then providing incentives through our fiscal instruments to make sure that they do the right thing to produce integrated urban spaces, which I was using the example of a Tegwin in relation to. Of course, we do provide broader technical capacity support, whether it's in finance, financial management, and we've got grants that we use to do some of this. And you find this, I think, under Program 8. Then we have the programs that are just attached to us, 7, your civil pensions and military pensions, and so on. Thank you very much, Chairperson. I mean, the statistics that summarize our human capital issues, they are self-explanatory, not readable to someone my age, but...
Can I say we should take the APP? Colleagues, are you fine with that? And then we deal with both. Okay. APP then. Are you going to take us through this one? Oh, this is SARS, right? So we've done the strat plan, right?
We are related to them, but
Sorry, it's my confusion. Okay, good. So are we going to take questions now? Floyd, Pinky, Mr. Lees, and Mr. Mania.
I wanted to check, DG, if this thing fundamentally different in this APP as compared to the previous year's APPs, or as compared to the APPs that were presented prior to the new minister and deputy minister of finance being appointed. Are there fundamental political and ideological changes or budget expenditures that have been shifted because the new political leadership has given a different guidance in that regard, so that we're able to keep track politically about that? Sure.
That's a disappointing question, but you're free to ask it. If I was a DG, I know I would reply, and you know too, but all right, fine. Floyd, you're running out of steam. Okay, right, who's next?
Me? Maybe just on the growth targets, Chair, I'm not sure whether DG and you will assist us, whether the targets also are alive to the current economic situation that we find ourselves in, so that we don't come back and say, hang on, by the way, we know it's still early. The impact of the downgrade will be felt later as we go forward. But from Treasury point of view, there may be something that you look at to say, will this be achievable and so on. But also, it will also be important as we go forward on how you think as Treasury you'll be working towards improving the situation given the downgrade that we find ourselves in, including how I know SOEs and other state-owned companies, the guarantees that they have been given, how exposed are we given some of these challenges that we find ourselves in, and what are the implications of some of those. DG, you will indicate to me whether, through the chair, whether what I'm saying is right or wrong, but I thought Somewhere as a committee we spoke and appropriated money to BRICS Bank. If I can drive to Joburg, to Sandton, street number Mama, office number Mama, will I get that bank operating and personnel hired? That's what I wanted to ask. And if the bank is there, is it accessible? Remember, there were other countries that also needed to contribute, and it means as we speak there's money, and has it started to do what it was intended to be doing? I was looking at program 4 and program 5. Whether those programs, one on supply chain, whether we affected in the tone that the minister spoke to, the supply chain issues, and how you think we need to start to sustain local business, medium and small businesses and so on, the tone of the minister. Whether this also, Program 5 speaks to that, and even Program 4, whether the way we have put it, we are also alive to the economic situation that we find ourselves in. I like your program that also supports municipalities. And you are also saying it in this report that they are highly indebted. And given the current economic situation, it means the interest on paying back some of the debts will also be a tall order for municipalities, especially because some, you know, the level of income in localities, given challenges of unemployment and other things, it's also a problem. Is there a program to work with those municipalities to make sure that their conduct going forward, of moving out of the debt, but also being alive to some of the situation? Those things will be dealt with. Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Right. TG, we've had a lot of banter about the sugary beverage tax. But what in terms of the implementation date, I think it was due to be implemented last month. Was it? Am I right? Soon, anyway. Yeah, the bill obviously needs to be passed, but I think in terms of the was there any budgetary implication here if this thing is delayed or never passed? And then on to my favourite subject, DG, the sovereign ratings are severely affected by SOEs and our guarantees that we give to them, and so in terms of SAA, where are we with that guarantee? If I do my own little calculations, and I've issued a statement saying this, so I hope I'm right, that they've used up the 19.114 billion, and because their losses for the last financial year are exceedingly high. I think the last figure was over 5 billion. So is Treasury now lining up to give them another guarantee to extend their borrowings? And what is the impact likely to be on our ratings? Then with regard to that same scare wave, the National Treasury were looking at the CIPC reports on the chair's non-conformance or violation of the Companies Act. Where have we got to with that? Now, there's an internal memo that was written to the board from the acting CEO, although it says CEO on it, relating to the lack of work visas for employees of Seabury Aviation. Was that brought to the attention of National Treasury, and what did National Treasury do about it? Because clearly SAA were aware of it, given this memo.
How did you get access to the memo?
It's on the internet, Mr.
Oh. I didn't expect you to reply. I was just saying, why don't Digi, you know what? They must leak to us, man, because we're the majority, right? They leak to the minority. So immediately we say we foreclose the possibility.
There was no leak, Mr. Chairman. Then, Mr. Chairman, to you, DG, the Minister replied to my question, which was submitted in my colleague's name yesterday, to say that the CFO for SAA had been approved by the board. Does that appointment come through to National Treasury or to the Deputy Minister? Can you tell us who the appointee is for CFO, if it's been approved?
But he's been appointed already.
According to the Minister's answer.
Oh, I didn't know that, because when I asked about appointing, I said 3 months. So I think it's a useful point you're making, Alf. I don't mean to interrupt you. It's just that I had recommended that in your report you say 3 months. But if they've already appointed somebody...
Be careful, Mr. Chairman. I think I'm talking about the CFO, not the CEO. Yes. Yeah, so the CEO hasn't yet been appointed. Okay. So, could you tell us who is the new CFO? When does he or she take up the position?
I don't mean to be rude again, but if you can help us. What date is that memo got attached to it? What date was the memo released?
Mr. Chairman, it's a reply to a written question, and the reply was tabled yesterday. So, yeah. Okay. No, not at all, Mr. Chairman. We're very accommodating on this side. And then, what progress has Bain & Co. Made with regard to recommendations on the merger and private equity partner? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Merger issue. This thing's on the agenda, but we don't really know what's going on. There should be some sort of response on that one, eh? I mean, you know, we need to know. Okay, who's next? Is Mr. Mania.
Thank you, Chair. We obviously, as a committee, need to watch contingent liabilities very carefully. And, of course, government guarantees are an important component of that. But what I would like is if you could give me a detailed description on who within Treasury is responsible for monitoring guarantees and the process that Treasury uses to decide whether guarantees are recommended or not recommended. I'd like a detailed description of the institutional arrangement and the disclosure arrangement that goes around government guarantees. I'd like to understand exactly how the institutional dynamics, if you like, work in respect to contingent liabilities and government guarantees.
Okay, Pinky forgot to ask a question. And
maybe just a small one, Chair. I think, you know, given the situation that we find ourselves in, probably National Treasury will have to adjust some of the implementation plans that they have. Twin Peaks being one of them. Are we able to start to look at the implementation of Twin Peaks Momo? I remember us talking about some big amount of money that will be needed to implement Twin Peaks. Is that still on track, or does it also want you to delay some of those things?
Before you come in, Alf, I'm sorry. We must insist, hey, Momo, that you have to check. I've spoken to the chair again. That those three provisions that were lost in the botch-up are in the bill. Yeah, that's non-negotiable, eh? Otherwise, there will be a conflagration here. We'll have to stop implementing that bill because we can't have that. So that's one thing I'll challenge you. Okay, being old and doddery, it's understandable. Alf forgot to ask a question.
Mr. Chairman, that's two of us. I it's right on the top, and how could I forget it? DG, it should have been asked in line with the guarantees, that the last guarantee issued, there were a whole lot of conditions attached. Do National Treasury get regular reports from SA on it? And if so, are you able to give us any information about progress?
Yeah, can you just pick up on the comments? Now, the researcher does this on behalf of the committee, or for the committee, not on behalf of it, but these are her views. And unlike the minister, she doesn't make public announcements as a researcher of this committee. So don't ask us about the relationship between Antonia. This is Antonia's views, but often, I want to say, DG, she and Zakhele are very good. And so often, we do actually, most of us, many of us, sometimes some of us, agree with the questions she asks. Right, go for it.
Thanks.
What are the issues you think we should raise? And we'd like you to respond, yes? Thank you.
Okay. In the past, the AG has also raised issues about Treasury not really conforming to the APP plans and so on, and really following the structure of it. But this year, clearly, I think we've made significant improvement, and I'm quite impressed in the way you've designed and followed that structure. Under Program 1, you've indicated to us that it takes you about, specifically with the APPs, it takes you about four to five weeks in your response for vacancies to be filled. And here we're struggling with, you're struggling with the Office of the Procurement Officer, and that doesn't really form around the turnaround time that you've actually committed yourselves to. So those are the issues again. And again, there's also, you've reported that the Minister is increasing the entities that report to him on a quarterly basis. Previously there were 40, but for some reason this year it's 44. So who are those four entities that have suddenly now are reporting to the Minister? The issue of vetting, we've raised it in the past, and this year in your report, in the APP, you said that you submitted 241 names to the state security. We want to know really what were the outcomes, the adverse outcomes that came out of those vetting processes that came from the state security, and what have you done? Have you taken action against those that really haven't complied, and what were the findings there? Program 2, the members have raised issues about the growth targets that you can address. There's also the issue about providing quarterly reports on you've committed to providing quarterly reports on the guarantees. Really, we want commitment. We want those reports to be provided to us. Program 8, the issue of GTAC. They're supposed to provide annual APPs, they're supposed to provide annual reports. We have not received that. Audited financials for 2015. Again, we want that kind of feedback on what is happening with GTAC. Who is actually the accounting officer? What is happening at GTAC? So in summary, that is pretty much what we were able to find.
So, I mean, DG, we don't expect you to give full answers here. Just very quickly, does anybody know when the debate's going to take place in the House on the budget vote? Does anybody, Alan, Tabor? 23rd? Is it 23rd?
Yeah.
What's the date today? Today is the?
Yeah,
2 weeks' time. All right, okay. So then in a week, not in a week, but what's today? Tuesday. By Friday you can give fuller replies. But go for it.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair and members. Of course, the answers are usually longer than the questions, naturally. So we're going to be here for some time. Honorable Floyd, no, there haven't been changes. I mean, I know that in the public domain, people kind of make a big story about this thing. A government system takes longer to change or turn direction than the biggest vessel you can imagine sailing oceans. It's the nature of the beast, right? When the minister and the deputy minister came, most of these documents had been printed, just for starters. That's the first point to make. The second point to make, I make it a lot to people, and I know your question had a particular nuance to it. A treasury is a treasury and is a treasury. A treasury, if you check the Constitution, Chapter 13, you check the PFMA, cover to cover, you will find that there are things that are expected of a treasury. Now, before Parliament has amended these laws, you can't expect that the functions of a treasury change. The approach to the work and those kinds of nuances change with different ministers, of course. It's not like the ministers, they just come and they are straight-jacketed. But the bulk of what we do is governed by law. And, of course, even more boringly, we will always produce a budget. And the budget will have expenditure side and tax side. There is no way of all of a sudden having it very different from that. But, of course, there will be things in terms of your fiscal stance, just the articulation of things and stuff like that, which will reflect that there is a different minister and a different deputy minister. That's what bureaucrats have got to do. I've had to do lots of it lately because I've had 5 ministers in 6 years. I know you don't believe this, but I can count. So you've got to adapt then to the style of the different ministers, which has not been necessarily very difficult. On the growth targets, the answer, Honorable Ping, is also in your question because it's a bit early to tell. I would say the first thing that takes a bit of a knock when there are changes like you've seen, it's just confidence. It's nebulous, you can't quite touch it, and curing it when it's affected is also as difficult. But what the minister has been trying to do, and I think quite effectively, is to just communicate a very consistent message of, one, the fiscal objectives of government have not changed. So you put that one to rest. The idea that there is a new minister is there now going to be fiscal looseness. He has dispelled that totally. So to the extent that the core function of a treasury, which is fiscal policy, there were doubts about it, say, when people woke up to a new cabinet, that one has, I think, been thoroughly dealt with. With all the investors that we've met, the minister has been firm to say nothing will change in terms of our fiscal objectives. He has been very clear and very effective in telling them that if and when there is a need to adjust things in line with slowing growth and whatever, he will do that. Because one of the most important points to make on this is that we don't do these things because rating agencies like them. We do these things because they make sense for South Africa and South Africans. And sometimes then in the communication, because when the question is asked, do you think that what you have done in this budget is enough to keep the rating agencies at bay? You are responding to a question and all of a sudden people say, we didn't know that you are doing this thing to... No. Fiscal rectitude, fiscal prudence, making sure that we don't over-indebt ourselves, and making sure that when we do indebt ourselves, it is more for investment rather than for consumption, are things that are good for us. The fact that rating agencies, when they rate us, look at those things is a beautiful coincidence. So there is no too much worries about that. And of course, as all the ministers have made this point, the way to get out of where we are is not just about cutting expenditure and raising taxes. Those two sets of actions combined buy us time. They just ensure that we don't go into a very deep, you can call it a crisis or difficult situation. The thing that would get South Africa on a decidedly firm path of a strong fiscal position is growth. It is growth. The economy must grow. And I hope I have made the point now, I don't know, because I'm talking a lot here, that there is only so much that you can get in terms of growth stimulation using fiscal measures. And in our case, in fact, you hardly have space to do that. You hardly. What you need to do is then structural reforms of various kinds, which will then reignite confidence, get investment growing, and get growth growing in ways that are inclusive than we have seen so far. Now, how do we... So, how will National Treasury work? There is little that National Treasury on its own would do to grow the economy with what it has. I'm saying little, not nothing. But the most important role that we've got to play is to lobby the rest of government to do the things that have to be done to grow the economy. Whether it's sorting out the skills problem in education throughout the system, whether it's making sure that legislations, pieces of legislation that are that have been lingering in the system forever or for a long time must be concluded so that then investment can take place in those sectors. And of course, it's about administrative processes where those are necessary to make sure that people get licenses, whether it's mining, whether it's for water, EIAs, all of those things are the things that must happen for growth to take place in an economy, for investment to take place, and then growth will follow. It is actually very important that different parts of the system must do their part to make sure that the economy grows. And it's a distraction. I mean, I can take liberties to say this, that people will always tend to the budget when the economy is not growing and say, what are you doing to grow the economy? At this stage, very little can be done. I'm not saying nothing, but very little can be done using the budget. But SOCs and guarantees, this question has come up a few times, so let me answer all of them in response to Honorable Pinky's question. I mean, the guarantee exposures aren't going to explode. I hope I don't eat my words, but I won't be here. No. That was said in jest. But the guarantee exposures are not about to explode over the next while. No. I don't think so. I mean, the biggest guarantee we have is the one that government gave to Eskom, $350 billion. That's, at this stage, the ceiling of it, I think it's about $210 billion thereabout that has been drawn down. People have been concerned about the somewhat accelerated drawdown, and I say to them, I'm surprised that you wake up now, because it could have been higher if Eskom was moving with its program faster, which they ought to have. Yes, because they are supposed to have finished their building of the two coal-fired power stations in 2017-18, or should be finishing now in 2017-18. The acceleration is partly because the program is moving, but also partly because when they applied for a tariff, they got less than what they were asking for, and therefore that had to come from borrowing and stuff like that. I usually say to people, but I mean, I'm not saying this lightheartedly or cavalierly. Once you go beyond ESCOM, if the system ensures that the guarantees to ESCOM never get called, the system would be fine by and large. Because if you think about it, I mean, it's that 350 billion. The next biggest guarantee is 38 billion to Sanra. 38 billion relative to the size of government's budget, relative to the size of our business, is substantial, but not, you know. I'm hoping that those who live in Gauteng have got tags. I still have my e-tag. I still pay my tolls. I topped up yesterday. I know that there are people who are not doing it. I'm not saying here. Yeah, I know. I mean, lawmakers don't break the law. But so Sanral is the next one, and there doesn't seem to be problems coming from that front. Then the next one would be your TCTA, I think. It's a very well-run business so far. And then the next one will be, I think, your SAA. So there aren't major changes in those guarantees. They are a concern for rating agencies. The concern for rating agencies, which is a concern for us as Treasury, and it should be a concern for South Africans, the businesses that government has guaranteed must be run well. There are no many ways about it. There should be no tolerance to poor governments. It's a simple thing. When people are employed to do a job and they are paid to do it, they must do it. Is the right kind of philosophy, I think. On SAA, which connects to the Honourable Liz's question and Honourable Mayneal, the guaranteed amount is just under 20 billion. I think the last time I checked, which was about a week or so ago, it was about 16.7 billion that they had drawn down. Thereabout. There's a lot of work that's happening with SAA. I mean, the CFO has been appointed, the chief financial officer, and part of the pressure we had was from the lenders. They were saying, you know, we can't be doing business with someone acting, but the system appointed the right person. In a lady by the name of Pumeza Nancy, she had acted for some time and actually really was doing a good job. Both the board members knew, and it would seem even the lenders to SAA, because they talk a lot almost every week, right? So all of those people quietly appear to be very confident in her abilities and stuff like that. She knows the business. She's doing a good job. The process is that the board would appoint a panel, and then they make a recommendation to the minister. I think usually if the minister says no, then the appointment doesn't proceed. But this time he agreed with them, and in fact it was signed by the new minister. And so that's a very positive development, because it was put as one of the conditions, by the way, by the lenders, that process must be finalized. So now it's the CEO's process that's moving. Is there a chance that they might ask for more? I wouldn't put my hand on my heart and say I know for sure they wouldn't, but it's important to just understand the context in relation to that the Minister of Finance, former, having consulted Cabinet, made the pronouncement, unambiguous pronouncement in February, that SAA is one of those entities that need a capital injection. And it will happen this year. What he didn't say was the number, I think. But that's what we are pondering with them. We've got to do it, because, I mean, you wouldn't want to have an airline and the airline needs equity and you don't put equity, because you're putting the lenders in an awkward position when you do that they may end up being penalized for lending recklessly in a way. The capital structure of the entity is inappropriate at this stage. Too much debt relative to equity. In fact, it may even be wrong to call it that. The entity might just be in negative equity to a substantial amount. So the processes that are underway to fix the business in terms of its operation, which are quite advanced, and we know this, and this answers yet another question that was asked. We talk to them every week. We participate in their conversations with lenders, and we have our own monitoring meetings with them weekly, looking at cash flows, looking at processes to change just the effectiveness and efficiency of the business. So it's obvious that a lot of good work is being done there. It's going to take a while for the entity to be in a good position. And that while will also include, I mean, we can say this definitively, will include government injecting substantial equity into SAA. Then over time, the entity should be okay, I think. So the point about this connecting to guarantees is that, you know, one cannot say definitively that between now and the cash injection there may be no need for guarantees, but as the equity injections come in this year and in future years, then the need for guarantees will be reduced. The last question on guarantees, which came from the Honourable Minister, is we publish in the budget review required by law in terms of the, I think it's in the procedure to amend Money Bills and Related Matters Act. There's a clause that talks to guarantees that every year Treasury must publish guarantees. It's not an option for us to do it for you. But of course, it's the second last question, is you are right, because we take a snapshot in February when we table the budget, then there's little that we tell you during the course of the year, and then we come again in February, which is where the researcher's question comes in, that it would be good. I'm not sure about the commitment of quarterly reporting, because things don't change dramatically quarter to quarter. Maybe it would make sense to just do the report twice a year. You know, that doesn't derogate from saying for this specific entity, because the risk is high, maybe there can be a way to give information. I usually say this to people: you can burden people, government officials, with reporting, and all they do is to report and not do the work, kind of thing, you know. So you've got to strike the right balance. There must be transparency, accountability, but at the same time, not too much burden. So you would see, when you look at the guarantees, and I'll get into the numbers, I hope quickly. I think that the total guarantees are around 400 and something billion, just the total exposure, but my colleague will help me with that. Then the amounts drawn down are in the ballpark of about 300 and something billion. The biggest proportion of it, as I said, it's Eskom at 200 and something. So it's like that. I think I've covered all the questions on guarantees. The institutional arrangement is the last one. In terms of the law, the minister can receive an application for a guarantee. Let me rephrase that. The minister is authorized to issue guarantees. And it's a power that he can't delegate, right, Momo? But we have a very solid institutional mechanism in the institution to deal with guarantees. It may be good, actually, I'm committing people now on my way out, to come and present this to you, because questions have been arising on guarantees. It may be good to just come and explain in very short meeting. Say, I can't impose, I mean, I'm only merely an outgoing director general. But what we do, entities apply for guarantees when they are not with us as the department, like the Land Bank, DBSA, SAA. They apply through the department that they fall under, the shareholder department. So if you think about ESCOM, it would be through DPE. If you think about SABC, it would be through the Department of Communications. So that department has got to do its own due diligence to say what went wrong, what is it that they would do, that they are promising to do to make sure that things don't get worse and blah, blah, blah. Then the application gets forwarded to the Minister of Finance for concurrence. But it can never, the guarantee can never be approved if the Minister of Finance has not agreed to it. Never. The law is written very clearly in that regard. Then in the Treasury, we have what we call a Fiscal Liability Committee, which comprises of, I think, 6 or 7 DDGs. Five. Okay. What's the difference? Let me put it this way. It comprises of DDGs. You say it's five. But DDGs. Public Finance, Budget Office, IGR, ALM, Economic Policy. Yeah, five. The chairperson of that is the DDG who heads liability management, asset and liability management. It's Anthony Julius now. Right? So what then happens is that there would be work done to look at what went wrong, what got the institution to need a guarantee, from governance, financial management, down to, and then look, assess the risk that if first make the assessment, is the entity really a candidate for a guarantee as opposed to equity? Because usually there's a problem if you just give an entity a guarantee today and then tomorrow it comes back, the lenders say we need our money, because then it's clear the entity needs a cash injection instead of equity injection. So those are kind of assessments that are made. The risk or the probability that the guarantee would be called, and then advise the minister. And underline, advise the minister, not direct him or her, that the only decision you can take is this, right? Based on that evidence and so on. Is there anything I'm leaving?
I think maybe what we need to maybe emphasize is that it's a very robust process whereby the officials in the assets and liability management, these are your financial analysts who would not look at any other than what the numbers dictate, present, and they'll obviously be supported by the sector unit, people who oversee or play an oversight role on a department. If it's energy, you combine the energy experts in the department and the financial analysts who would be housed in Assets and Liability Division. They will make a case for or against approval. And then they present to five of us, and what we normally do is to remove ourselves from the attachment. In my case, as DDG Public Finance, I will remove myself for being a spokesperson for the Department of Communications or Energy, whatever. And then purely look at the basis of the case that they are making. And once we are, as a committee, convinced that it is the right thing to advise the minister to approve or not approve based on the numbers. When I say the numbers, I mean, does it make economic sense? Will the department, will the entity be able to repay? What's the financial arrangement? What are the governance issues? Are they in place? And all of those questions have been asked. What is there that will make us, because remember, if we approve a guarantee and the department or the entity doesn't perform, effectively the call on the fiscus, as you know, and we have to come back to Parliament to say you have to settle the bill. So we have to convince ourselves that it's a thorough financial analysis that's in place, and that we won't have sleepless nights if we grant the guarantee, because the department, the entity will be able to perform. If you take SNE as an example, it took long before we could give that 5.4 billion because we were not comfortable. Because the committee or the Fiscal Liability Committee can also call on the entity to make certain things, put certain things in place, long-term turnaround strategy, appointments, and so on and so on. And all of these things will be brought to the attention of the minister to make or not to to grant or not to grant approval in terms of what's been requested. So it's a very thorough process, and then based on that analysis, then the minister then determines, or the committee recommends and a grant to be granted or not. And then based on that, the department is then informed and the entity then can be informed.
And of course, thanks, Sondo, then there would be conditions, depending on what gave rise to the precarious financial position, the conditions would go with that and reporting requirements. Similarly, the monitoring, the intensity thereof depends on the gravity of the situation that is at the entity. Bearing in mind that our capacity is not limitless ourselves. Now, I don't want to leave my colleagues with a problem. I mean, we have to add, Dondo, there are instances where the choices are quite difficult because sometimes the entity may come and you realize it's very hard to follow everything to the T. So the way sometimes to buy time is to give the guarantee when other processes take place. I want to emphasize this, because there will be instances where the guarantee is a kind of a holding position. And you would remember, I mean, we did this with the land bank. We knew that the right thing was the cash injection, but government didn't have the money at the time. So when you give the guarantee and you take the guarantee off and replace it with cash, so there will be cases like that and so on. The person who's appointed the CFO is at work. She was there acting previously. The bail process has just been finished.
DG, you gave a very elaborate explanation of guarantees.
Yes.
I was going to suggest to the committee we put it into the next quarter, right?
Okay.
But you've covered so much of ground.
Yes.
But I'm a bit worried about time. There are also practical administrative things people like myself have to do.
Yes.
And I need at least half an hour away from this meeting. So I'm happy if somebody else wants to chair. But what I would like to suggest is that you round up in the next 5 minutes. If that's the case, I'll stay. Otherwise, I'll have to leave. Pinky, you can take over. And you can work right through. Have 5 minutes for lunch and continue. I'm cool. So what is the meeting's view? The other option is as I said, replies by Friday, and then we'll insert those replies into the report. So what is the meeting? You want 5 minutes for lunch, or you want half an hour or so for lunch? Sorry? Yeah, I've also got practical. So can we round up in 5 minutes? I do appreciate, by the way, your replies. I find them very interesting, actually, and very informative. I do, but it's just time. Yeah, thank you.
I know you just like me, Chair, but that's fine. We come a long way.
UNP guy.
We come a long way from that institution. On the NDB, the NDB has got an office, Daisy Street. It is Daisy Street in Sante. We pay rent. In fact, now we may even have switched it over to... no, we haven't yet switched it to the NDB. So it exists in Sante. The formalities, though, haven't been done. And it's just us... It's largely from South Africa's side that the processes have been taking long. I will just leave it at that. The bank is operational in Shanghai. Eskom applied for and got a loan from the bank in the first round of applications that they invited. They have now invited a second round of applications. Whether we get money or not, it's going to depend on how good or otherwise our own applications are in terms of the projects we put on the table. But the bank is there, it's operational, it's ready to give us loans if and when we apply. Look, on the things about the CPO job, I mean, when it was vacated, the previous minister sort of said, look, let's take a bit of time, and I agreed with him to advertise the job, because there were things that were at a stage where you just want them to pass a particular stage rather than focus on it. The job was advertised a few weeks ago. The minister is in the process of setting up the panels to speed that up. Most of the questions I've answered. I mean, GTEC has got its own accounting officer. It is now a gentleman called Shahid Khan. You can ask him other questions. I think that we've answered just about everything. Yeah. The people who didn't have visas, it was drawn to our attention, but I do know that they are working actually very well, CBRE, at SAA. The specific individuals who were struggling with things, we were told, I don't know the status with them. On municipalities, debt and stuff like that, I will ask Mary Jane to just touch on that, and that will be the last comment from our side.
Okay. Momo wants to say something as well. Okay, go for it, Mary Jane, and then Momo can follow.
Yeah. No, thank you, Chair. With regard to the municipal debt, obviously it is a major issue and which came to a head last year when Eskom started cutting off some of the municipalities. And out of that, there has been a lot of initiatives by various stakeholders. So all we needed to do now was to better coordinate ourselves. So we have pulled together a support program, which the minister even announced in the budget, that is based on four key, what we call game changers, which are the programmatic approach in trying to look at the roots of the problem. You know, that looks at ensuring that the budgets are funded, that the municipality table funded budgets, and that is what provincial treasurers now need to make sure that even the payment plans that they have agreed with Eskom, that actually they are reflected, built into the budget. So part of that also is to make sure that they have got reasonable estimates of revenue, but also in terms of the spending, they are also containing their costs because there is a lot of waste, operational waste in their budget. So we want to be able to see that actually happening. So we also will be focusing a lot on in the whole revenue management, which is a big project that we are supporting, and also asset management, because part of the challenge here is that there's a lot of losses, you know, because of failure to maintain the assets. So that is really looking at, you know, you can say technical aspects. But the truth is, there are also governance challenges, where even if you have got this program and you are offering it through also our financial management improvement program that we have kind of revised, which will also provide additional technical support. But part of the problem is how do you make sure that there is commitment both at the leadership of the administration and at the political level. So that is the part where we are trying also to collaborate even with COCTA, because you need to address those governance issues where you need to make sure that there is municipal manager, there is CFO who is competent, but they are also able to look at organizational structure, which are often very, very overbloated in those things. So we are trying to pull that together. But also we would want to link that with possible intervention in the form of 216 or Section 139, because we did pull 216 2 years ago. It wouldn't help if you're also not supporting them to build credible budgets going forward. So I think those are, you know, the kind of approaches that we're going to try to address, also trying to strengthen our coordination with COCTA, SALGA, and at the provincial level.
Okay, I'll be really brief. I think on the sugar tax, we didn't really have a time. It's obviously a way to the bill, so that's why there's no numbers put in on revenue yet. And secondly, on Twin Peaks implementation, we're waiting also for the bill to get through. There will be a very simple money bill that will have to be introduced. But remember, all of those costs are effectively paid through license fees, so the financial sector pays to be regulated. So there's very little on the budget here. Very little or nothing.
Thank you very much. We return here. Sorry, Elf. Yes, I was about to say, presumably this is the last time we do see him. I thought about it earlier, but I got distracted. Can we once again take the opportunity, DG, of thanking you very effusively for the excellent work you've done over the years, and to express our appreciation. We have our differences, and so it must be. I mean, if a DG and a committee are always, like the minister said earlier, synergy, then the parliament is not doing its job, or you're not doing your job. We must have a constructive, critical, what's the word? Constructively critical exchange. So we want to thank you for everything. As I keep saying to you privately, you're too young to exit the public sector, so we hope that you will get reasonably bored soon with your farming, and you can devote and come back in some form or the other to the public sector. So once again, thank you very much and all good wishes. You have a mandate from the so-called shadow minister.
Mr. Chairman,
would you have said that if he was here?
He's not here, he's not listening, so I can say what I like. And so for the record, we do appreciate all the hard work of many years that you have put into this job and done it so well. Thank you so much.
And on behalf of Floyd Chivambu, who is writing the next document for the EFF, I would like to say that despite the EFF fundamentally disagreeing with your ideological perspective and believing that you're a running dog of imperialism and capitalism, by the standards of a neo-imperialist, they think you performed quite well, except that they opposed to you on class.
I can speak on behalf and say farewell, DG, and we appreciate the contributions that you've made, and we respect you. And let's hope that there won't be attempts to discontinue at least principle and consistency in terms of how national treasury should be managed, because we must not play games with important institutions. So you must do well in your next attempts. Shasha.
Never mind what Alexandra Kollontai said about marriage. You see the effect of marriage? I would urge those of you here, both in the committee and not, please get married. You become far more, generous towards your class enemies. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Relocate with you. The fact that Thank you. Thank you. know where they are? You think that I'm clever. You think that I'm clever.
Mm-hmm.
I will show you that I'm not clever. Here is the table.
I'll try.
In the budget review.
In the budget review.
Now let's put it this way, so that that appears.
Okay, so all the
I was saying, the currency is 477, right?
477.
The actual exposure, which means those that are drawn down, is 308.
Drawn down is 308.
Of that 308, ESCOM was 2018. That is now at February.
Okay.
At the time of the
yes.
I said total 138, you see that states that they've gone down. You go to the table.
Okay, so that's
page 92.
Okay.
So that you don't think, you can just quote that, not me.
Okay.
Sure.
I'm outside.
Yeah, okay, mom.